The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Jousting over jobs, slowing growth under Obama versus outsourcing pioneered by Romney's Bain Capital, and the mandate debate continues.
Worst of the worst, human rights abusers from around the world, from bloody Syria to friend foe Saudi Arabia. The annual Freedom House report.
Making sense of Mexico, its disputed presidential election, and disastrous war on the drug trade still plaguing the United States.
Olympic London, the pride, preparations, and expectations for Summer Games 2012 and their aftermath.
What about Medicare? Not directly addressed by the Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare and Medicaid expansion, it's also the focus of reform and controversy.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of July 8th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
The Supreme Court is the final word, right? Isn't that the highest court in the land? They said it was a tax, didn't they? So it's a tax, of course. That's what they say it is.
The Washington Post has just revealed that Romney's companies were pioneers in shipping U.S. jobs overseas, investing in firms that specialized in relocating jobs done by American workers to new facilities in low-wage countries like China.
Mitt Romney began the week with another reversal, citing the Supreme Court decision that Obamacare's individual insurance mandate was only constitutional as a tax. The dirty word conservatives want a tattoo on President Obama. Uncomfortably for Romney, it also meant a similar mandate that he oversaw as governor of Massachusetts could be targeted as a tax as well. And Romney was also being hurt by a Democratic TV ad blitz, underscoring his Bain Capital record on company profits versus U.S. jobs.
Jobs became the watchword later in the week, with a disappointing report of only 80,000 added last month and no change in the 8.2 unemployment rate. Not good news for Obama, but no less a Republican sounding board than the Wall Street Journal editorial page charged that Romney and his team were not moving effectively enough on that and other key campaign issues. To consider all those developments and trends in the campaign to come, For Your Ears Only, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a contributor at NewsweekDailyBeast.com. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you.
To what degree do you see those ads on outsourcing jobs by Bain Capital counterbalancing painfully slow job growth under Obama in this election year?
Well, I think there's no way to pretend that the jobs picture is anything but dismal. And the president has to cast the choice for the voters as to which of the candidates will do better in the next 4 years. And so I think undercutting Governor Romney's claim that he is a job creator because of his record at Bain is really essential for the White House to frame this election. And it's really a race to define Mitt Romney. It's remarkable if you travel around the country at all, really how little people know about him. And these, you know, snippets get through. And I think if you look at the polls that the ad blitz that the Obama campaign and their allies have been running have taken a toll on Romney's claim that as president he has some sort of magic elixir that could create jobs.
Especially in swing states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, I gather. Former McCain campaign manager Steve Schmidt says jobs numbers like we saw last week, disappointing but still positive, will probably not change voters' sense of the economy and how it affects their votes. Other analysts suggest there's a much higher number under which Obama is toast. What's your view?
Well, I think voter attitudes do begin to get locked in. And if you look at the electorate, there are very few undecided voters. And I think the two campaigns are fighting over those narrow bands of voters. And they're the ones who can decide the election. And I think if the unemployment rate stays steady at 8.2, Obama can probably still survive. But if it begins to climb up and this stall that we appear to be in worsens, then Romney becomes an acceptable alternative, I think, in the eyes of the American people. And that's why you have all this negative advertising on the part of the Obama people, is to lessen his appeal as an alternative so that people, you know, don't just roll the dice and think, well, let's take a chance since the Obama record is not working.
What about Republican criticism of Romney and his team reflected in the Wall Street Journal, as well as some negative tweets by the Journal's owner, Rupert Murdoch?
I think it's extraordinary. Rupert Murdoch seems to think, because of his empire, that he can somehow pull the strings of a presidential campaign. And, of course, Romney has met with him more than once and would very much like to have his support. And Murdoch controls some very important media outlets that reach conservatives. And a big concern for Romney is whether the Republican electorate, conservatives, will be energized about his candidacy. And when you have all this negative sniping about his campaign, I think it really does dampen enthusiasm. And there was a Pew poll which showed that Republicans, you know, find the race boring, whereas Democrats are getting kind of interested because, you know, they're worried, first of all, that their candidate might not win, and they see the stakes. And so I think Murdoch's role is it really does hurt Romney a lot.
To what degree do you think the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare will impact the presidential election, maybe energizing those conservatives who lost more than those who won?
Yeah, but I think that the conservatives energized about Obamacare were pretty energized even before the Supreme Court decision. And I think, in a way, the Supreme Court decision helps each campaign in perhaps equal measure, because Democrats now get a rare do-over in American politics. The president can now start selling the Affordable Care Act, and people can begin to realize that there are some positive things in it for them. So I think it's hard to parse out, you know, which campaign benefits more by this very controversial ruling.
Does the Supreme Court ruling that the individual mandate is a tax give opponents in Congress more running room to vote it and maybe all of Obamacare out of existence?
I really don't think so, because this tax, if you want to call it a tax, would affect only the segment of the population that can afford health care and chooses not to buy it. Governor Romney called them free riders. And in Massachusetts, it's less than 1% of the population. So if Massachusetts is a guide, this is not a broad-based tax that's going to affect everybody. And so, again, it's a fight over the sound bites. Republicans are saying it's the biggest tax increase in history, and the Democrats are trying to get the facts out. And in this overheated media atmosphere, again, it's a race to the finish to see, you know, which side's sound bites succeed. But, you know, I just don't think the election is going to turn on tax versus penalty. If we were in a rational world, Mitt Romney would be running on his health care plan. He did a good job in Massachusetts, and he'd be saying, I got there first. I did it before President Obama. Vote for me. He might even get my vote then.
Obama effectively killed public financing in the last presidential election. Is there some poetic justice now that the Supreme Court Citizens United decision seems to put the president at a disadvantage in private fundraising and spending, especially by the super PACs?
Oh, yes. That's an interesting way to look at it. President Obama did choose not to accept federal financing, which was another nail in what was already a coffin for that program. So I think it would have gone with or without him. But he is on track now to be the first incumbent president to face re-election and to be outspent by his opponent. And the phone conversation that the Daily Beast wrote about, where had the president was essentially begging for money from Air Force One, was pretty degrading, I think, for the presidency. And the flood of money coming into this campaign, they've already spent more on ads than were spent during the entire Bush-Gore campaign in 2000. And that was no cakewalk either. So American public is going to really have to brace themselves for this barrage of really mostly negative advertising paid by all sorts of special outside interests.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a contributor at NewsweekDailyBeast.com.
Quote from the news, these are not big steps, but I think they move in the right direction. That was former Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Donald Cohn after three of the world's biggest central banks in China, Europe, and England announced new reduced rates to stimulate borrowing and spending. International banking also lost credibility with mounting signs that England's venerable Barclays Bank was involved in manipulation of a key worldwide lending rate.
Next, bloody Syria and the rest of The Worst of the Worst for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. We are sorry for the losses. That was the statement by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that Islamabad agreed to accept as an apology for the U.S. airstrike that accidentally killed 24 PAC border troops and closed its Afghan border to Allied transport trucks for 7 months at a cost to Washington of $1 billion in extra shipping charges. Now this.
Syria is undergoing a violent internal conflict that has killed 6,000 to 15,000 people in the last 18 months. The Syria files shine a light on the inner workings of the Syrian government and economy, but they also reveal how the West and Western companies say one thing and do another.
Another document dump promised by WikiLeaks was likely the least of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's worries last week. Days later, a top general with long family ties to the regime publicly defected, and growing unrest was reported throughout the military on which Assad's repressive rule depends. But his regime's escalating war with opposition forces and attacks on their civilian supporters underscored Syria's place among 9 worst of the worst nations in the annual report on political rights and civil liberties just published by Freedom House.
In that group, as well as it has been since the surveys began 39 years ago, is nuclear North Korea. Oil-rich Saudi Arabia, a nominal U.S. ally, is there too. Also Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tibet, and Western Sahara. Among 7 other countries and 1 territory listed as on the threshold are Libya, where elections are being held this weekend, and Myanmar, the former Burma, which recently liberated longtime opposition figure Aung San Suu Kyi, permitting her belated acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize. Also on the threshold, Belarus, Chad, China, Cuba, Laos, and South Ossetia.
To talk more about the list, the trends it reveals, and what more the rest of the world can do, for your ears only, we're joined again by Arch Puddington, Vice President of Research at Freedom House. Welcome back to our program.
It's great to be here.
First, what are the scales by which you measure freedom for this annual report?
We look at a very extensive group of indicators that range from whether there are elections, whether there are institutions of pluralism, whether minorities have rights, whether there's gender equality, the level of corruption, the level of transparency in government, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, rule of law. These are the main issues that we look at, and on these issues, the countries that we're talking about today fall short on every one of them.
Let's turn to Syria. Do you think last week's defection and reports of widespread discontent in the ranks set the stage for a military victory by opposition forces?
I think it sets the stage, or it's just another step towards the eventual departure of Assad and his replacement by some other government. It's not clear what that government would consist of, but I think that his days are numbered.
This is not a case where the world needs more information about the bloody repression. Do you see any likelihood of outside military intervention, as happened in Libya, or will China and Russia finally be persuaded to apply serious diplomatic and economic pressure for Assad to step aside?
At a certain point, I think Russia in particular could step in and exert pressure on Assad to leave. Even as Russia has stayed in support of Assad, it has from time to time indicated that it understands that Assad's position is weak, that he could be forced out. And I do think that Russia does not want to be there supporting him to the bitter end and be an outcast nation to the new whatever new government comes in.
Could this be something of a sham, though? Would any agreement that Assad accepts leave his power base intact to run the country, as many think has happened with the generals who took over for President Mubarak in Egypt?
I think it's less likely in Syria than it was in Egypt, and for this reason. Syria is, among other things, a tribal and ethnic conflict, and which Egypt was not. What I think is more likely in Syria is something that we've seen in Iraq, where, you know, one group was repressed, it's the majority group, and when the transformation came, that group became the dominant group. So I think in Syria what you're going to see is the Sunnis, who are the majority there, the clear majority, they will take over.
Let's turn to Libya, where elation over the removal of Muammar Gaddafi has turned to complaints about old ethnic and regional divisions shaping this weekend's elections. What's your view?
Libya is not a real nation state in the way that Egypt is or that Syria is. And I think it's going to be very difficult for any government that's elected to forge a cohesive government and nation state in a country that's been a kind of collection of tribes and regions in the past. So I think it's going to be very difficult. I will say that many of the things I've heard about Libya over the past year have given some hope for optimism, because it does seem that people there really genuinely look forward to democracy, look forward to elections, look forward to having a regular civilian government. So we'll just have to see what happens.
What should we make of Washington's continued reliance on Saudi Arabia, despite its well-deserved place among the worst of the worst?
Well, there are two issues here. One is oil, energy, and let's face it, energy-rich countries have always had a they've always been judged by a different human rights standard. I mean, if you look at even a country like Russia or Venezuela or some of the countries in Africa that now have oil, the United States and Europe and other democracies just don't come down on them as hard as they do on countries that don't have energy. And the other issue, of course, is that Saudi Arabia has lined up with willy-nilly with the United States in some of these conflicts within the Middle East, especially the Iran conflict. And Saudi Arabia has positioned itself as the leading opponent of an Iranian-dominated Middle East. And I think for that reason, the United States sees Saudi Arabia as a clear ally in its struggle against Iran.
The report also sees intensifying repression in China as it goes through a change in leadership and a military buildup, but it also remains key to what passes for economic stability in the U.S. What do you see as Washington's best response?
No American government, from Richard Nixon on through Barack Obama, has really gone to the mat and demanded democratic reforms in China. I think there is a special responsibility for institutions and people of influence outside the government to speak clearly and with force about what's going on in China. People in Hollywood, writers, people from the cultural world, obviously NGOs, scholars, universities, these various centers of influence that are outside the government, they have a special responsibility to do what the government should be doing where China is concerned.
Arch Puddington is Vice President for Research at Freedom House.
Quote from the news, all these bases are within the reach of our missiles. That was Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, Iran's Air Force commander, on reports of stepped-up U.S. military forces in the Persian Gulf region to increase pressure against Iranian nuclear development and prevent its closing the Strait of Hormuz.
Next, drugs, violence, political division. What to make of Mexico? For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. A profoundly man-made disaster that could and should have been foreseen and prevented. That was the conclusion of Japan's Fukushima Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission criticizing the Tokyo Electric Power Company, government officials, and regulators for the absence of better safety preparations and procedures. It also indicated that standards shared by many of the nation's atomic power plants, all but one still offline, may have crippled Fukushima in last year's big earthquake before the subsequent tsunami. Now this.
We represent the indignation of the people facing an avalanche of anti-democratic irregularities, including overspending of campaign budgets, vote buying with money from dodgy sources, intimidating and threatening the population in order to win the elections.
More swiftly than they may have expected, protesters in Mexico City last week won their demand for a recount in the previous weekend's national election. But when Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute finished its tally of about half of all votes cast, the results were only slightly off the initial fast count, a 38% plurality and return to the presidency for the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, a dozen years after being dumped as too dictatorial, among other charges, in 7 decades of previous rule.
PRI candidate Enrique Peña Nieto had promised his party had changed its ways, but leftist runner-up Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the Democratic Revolutionary Party quickly threatened a legal challenge to the election and did not rule out street demonstrations like those sparked by his narrow loss in 2006. Third-place candidate Josefina Vázquez Mota of the ruling National Action Party also complained of election inequities, but said the answer was electoral reforms for the future.
Meanwhile, Mexicans and the world waited for the first signs of what President Peña Nieto would mean for the country's struggling economy and bloody war with drug cartels that has killed more than 50,000 people in the last 6 years without significantly curtailing the main flow of narcotics to the United States. To consider the election and the fallout for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Elise Dunn, an analyst at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What was the main complaint against current President Felipe Calderon of the National Action Party, the PAN? A bad economy or that escalating drug war?
Both of those issues really were on the mind of all Mexicans on Sunday for the election. On the economic side, Mexicans have voted the PRI back since they recall a PRI at the height of its power when the country was deemed Mexican miracle, forgetting, unfortunately, that Mexico was led astray by PRI leadership during the economic crises of the 80s and 90s, but they are frustrated with a stagnating economy under PAN rule for the past 12 years. On the drug war side, of course, much of the election was a referendum against, you know, the horrific costs of the drug war initiated by the PRI president 6 years ago. And again, unfortunately, the PRI and Peña have presented no real signs of a change in that strategy, so much is up in the air.
What was behind Mexico's former president Vicente Fox of the PAN calling for unity behind the winner, even if it was not from his own party?
Much of the media coverage of that announcement by President Vicente Fox focused on the wrong issue. He's really suggesting that uniting around the winner, whoever that would have been when he suggested it, it will be essential, he said, he is arguing, for Mexico in taking any steps forward for the country's battle with insecurity, violence, and, you know, economic stagnation, not to mention democratic reform.
By contrast, how far do you expect Obrador to carry his challenge to the election in the courts, and how disruptive could that be to a successful transition to Peña Nieto?
Well, certainly I would expect until the rest of July, and perhaps until the official declaration by the Federal Electoral Institute in September. However, I would not expect is for the uprisings by all of the Mexican people to mirror those uprisings that followed the 2006 election. And that's largely since the margin of Peña's win is so much more than Calderon's was in 2006.
You've mentioned that the president-elect hasn't really given much indication of how his war on drugs is going to be different, although he did take on to his campaign a police general from Colombia's drug war as a special advisor. I mean, does that give us any clue?
Who you're mentioning is General Oscar Naranjo. That general is credited with breaking new ground in the battle over drug cartels in Colombia. The general has not refuted, to this point, making temporary alliances with the cartels in Colombia. Such state cartel alliances are what some fear Peña Nieto will resort to, considering some of his connections and those of the PRI of the past. I would expect forming alliances is very much on the table for his administration strategy, despite his claims that his administration would, promises a straight-line approach in dealing with the cartels. But yeah, certainly questions remain as to the tactics and strategies he would use considering his appointment of the general.
What was the PRI's past policy on the economy, and what approach has Peña Nieto promised to take to stimulation, privatization, and nationalization?
So the first part of that question is very interesting, and it brings up an important part of the PRI's history that many people and those in the media are overlooking. The PRI was built on a nationalistic, protectionist, state-led economic model. And, of course, this is following It's you know, far back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s. So that era, that model was much driven behind Mexico's early success. That success during those periods was led by state-owned enterprises. And however, the downfalls of the import substitution industrialization strategy and the rise of the Washington Consensus saw a parallel shift in the political elite of the PRI, from the old guard dinos or dinosaurs to the new guard, Chicago school trained new guard. Neoliberalism opened up the PRI to a legacy of corruption and wastefulness in the wholesale sellings of state owned enterprises. And of course, we all think of Carlos Slim in the telecommunications industry. So on the one hand, the PRI's historic economic stance has represented both extremes of that ideological spectrum. But Peña Nieto's proposal of introducing private investment to Pemex, the state-owned nationalized petroleum producer and national symbol of Mexico, suggests he'll probably remain within the neoliberal NAFTA-era economic stance, certainly more towards privatization, more towards open economic relationships, both the United States and I would expect very much so with other regions, specifically across the Pacific.
Elise Dunn is an analyst at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington.
Quote from the news, "I think we have it." That was Dr. Ralf-Dieter Huhr, Director General of the CERN Physics Research Center in Geneva, on the discovery of a new subatomic particle, the elusive Higgs boson or something much like it, that could be key to creation of matter as we know it.
Next, Olympic London, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The defendant was preparing to flee. That was Florida Judge Kenneth Lester on the discovery that George Zimmerman, accused of second-degree murder in the Trayvon Martin shooting, had a second passport in a safe deposit box. The judge also faulted Zimmerman for failing to accurately reveal his finances in an initial bail proceeding, but set him free again on an increased $1 million bond. Now this.
There's a little city flower every spring unfailing, growing in the crevices by some London railing. Though it has a Latin name in town and countryside, we in England call it London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be.
The elegant Noel Coward's World War II tribute to London comes to mind today as the historic city prepares to play proud host to the 2012 Summer Olympics later this month. Even the song's wartime roots have resonance given today's concerns about terrorism in a town where public transport has already been attacked. Just last week, a major highway was closed because of suspicious smoke on a bus. Turned out to be from an electronic cigarette substitute. More serious was the arrest that same day of five people not far from the Olympic Stadium on charges of plotting terrorism, though not necessarily tied to the Olympics.
The larger threat to London, as many see it, is that the Games' $15 to $20 billion cost will not bring an even greater return in Olympic revenues, revive international interest in investment and development to last long after the final parade of champions. Boston Globe staff writer Shira Springer explored all those issues on a recent assignment in London, and she's on the line now for your ears only. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
We've already mentioned the price tag for hosting the Games. Give us the other relevant statistics, number of nations, athletes, and visitors expected.
Well, there are going to be more than 200 national sports delegations at the Games that are bringing more than 10,500 athletes, and the City of London is expecting 600,000 international visitors. And you add all that to a population of London that's about 8 million. London ranks as Europe's second largest city.
If the credo for Olympic contenders is higher, faster, stronger, the motto for many host cities has been bigger, bolder, and more expensive. But you found some leaders of London's Games seeing success as an Olympic scaled down for an era of austerity. Talk about that.
Everybody realizes now in the current economy that these 20, 30, 40 billion dollar gains might not be the way of the future, and that you are going to have to rein in the spending a little bit, be a little bit smarter about how you build venues, but particularly how you make use of venues after the game. So there was, at least in the planning stages, a real consideration as to how the venues would be used after the games and sort of the ongoing legacy of the London Games to make sure that once the crowds departed, it wasn't just an expenditure of 15 to 20 billion for the games, but an expenditure of 15 to 20 billion for a better London post game.
Interestingly, austerity was also a watchword the last time London hosted the games. Remind us of that.
Yeah, in 1948, London hosted the games after World War II, and those games are actually known as the austerity games. And it was a time, obviously, of still of great rationing. You know, there was a shortage of housing in London, and athletes were housed in RAF camps and colleges in the area. They were asked to bring their own food. And, you know, instead of these brand new architecturally stunning venues that we're so familiar with from the recent Olympics, they just sort of converted existing venues and existing buildings into sports arenas.
You talk about the big investments that cities made in the years that follow, but a number of host cities have been disappointed by the lack of return they made on their Olympic investment.
Think about how much Beijing spent. You know, people say it's upwards, estimates are upwards of $40 billion to host that games with 300 million, rather, going to the opening ceremony. And, you know, we'll all remember the fantastic architectural feat that was the Bird's Nest, which was the track and field stadium, the main stadium. They still haven't found a good use for that.
In fact, talk about the way that development that has been undertaken, transportation, accommodation, shopping, is already changing the East London area where the games are going to be held.
One of the key components of London sort of getting everybody or Great Britain getting everybody on board with the Olympic bid process 7 years ago or even before that was that the key component of the bid be that East London, this long neglected sort of industrial wasteland, be regenerated. The Olympic Park sits in Stratford and it has completely reinvigorated and remade this East London section. There is a new shopping mall with 300 stores and a casino. Businesses are investing. The Olympic Village will be turned into affordable housing. So they really use the Olympics as an impetus to convert this entire section of London. And they see this area of Stratford where the Olympic Park is as a new hub for the city as the city expands eastward because it really can't go much more westward.
We've read that some locals are upset by finding anti-aircraft weapons on top of their apartment houses, and we noted both the false alarm and real terrorism arrest last week. What mood did you sense among ordinary Londoners? Anticipation, exhilaration, dread?
I would say when I was there, dread far outweighed anticipation and eagerness. I'll give you one example. I was caught in three delays in the tube, two minor, one severe, where the conductor actually asked us to leave the subway station and walk to our destination. And as I was walking, I met a young man from Singapore who was going to school at the London School of Economics. And I asked him, you know, casually about the Olympics, and he just was dreading the prospect of all these visitors coming in. He said, look at this. Here we are having to walk to our next station. They can't even get the transportation right on a normal rush hour day. How do you expect them to handle 600,000 visitors? Now, I've been assured by Olympic organizers that they have tested and worked through and tried all different scenarios and built out the transportation systems among other infrastructure improvements that they've made. But still, it is going to tax the system.
Shira Springer is a Boston Globe staff writer who will be heading back to London for the Summer Olympics later this month. Now, with the threat of terrorism in mind, a little more coward who actually mixed some wartime intelligence work with his celebrity globetrotting.
Every blip your resistance toughening, from the wrist to the anchor and crown, nothing ever could override the prize of London Town.
Next, modernizing Medicare for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. I wasn't going to choose my job over someone in danger. That was Thomas Lopez, the Miami area lifeguard, fired last week for saving a swimmer in distress, but leaving his assigned beach zone without approval of a supervisor. After a public outcry, Lopez was offered his job back, but declined. Now this.
Look, federal dollars aren't free. Those dollars are coming from us, from our children, our grandchildren. We're borrowing money from China to spend on government programs we can't afford.
Last month's controversial Supreme Court decision confirming most of Obamacare also ruled against its expansion of federal and state-funded Medicaid, finding unconstitutional the threat that states would lose all current Medicaid money from Washington if they didn't agree with getting more for giving more. As Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal last week on NBC's Meet the Press insisted he would not. Little mention in all the commentary were reforms under consideration for traditional Medicare, the larger, fully federal program on which a growing constituency of seniors relies.
As president of the Center for Medicare Rights, Joe Baker last week submitted testimony on that controversy to the Subcommittee on Health of the House Ways and Means Committee. The center is a national nonprofit organization that works to ensure access to affordable health care for children, the elderly, and the disabled. And to explain the issues, for Your Ears Only, Joe Baker's on the line now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Your testimony was a response to an earlier report to Congress by the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. Tell us in layman's terms what main changes it proposed and with what rationale.
Sure. There are three main changes for the benefits for Medicare, for people that rely upon it, for beneficiaries. One is to modernize the program. So we all know if we had health insurance 10, 20 years ago that we had a hospital plan, a hospitalization plan, and a major medical or doctor plan. And Medicare is still structured like that, although health insurance for people under 65 isn't structured like that. So combining deductibles and other pieces of those two policies together. The second idea was to create what's called an out-of-pocket maximum. Once again, this is something that health insurance policies for those under 65 have, and that is once you get to a certain point, say $3,000 or $5,000 of your own out-of-pocket spending, everything's covered in full. You have no more $20 copays or deductibles. The insurance kicks in full as a kind of protection to fully cover you at that point. And then finally, what MedPAC proposed was to put a surcharge on, or a tax, if you will, or otherwise curtail the ability of people with Medicare to get supplemental insurance, sometimes called Medigap, or some have it through as a retiree of a company, that picks up what's called first dollar coverage. So many people go to the doctor, Medicare pays 80%, and their Medigap plan or their retiree plan from their former employer pays the other 20%, meaning they don't have any costs up front. People with Medicare like these policies because they live on fixed incomes. They can cost quite a bit of money, some of them, $250 a month, let's say, on average. But they like that kind of feeling of security, and that first dollar coverage makes sure that they know what their health budget will be for the year. So those were the three main things that MedPAC did, and all of them are good ideas in and of themselves, except that what they tend to do in the way MedPAC put them forward is to shift costs to people with Medicare, and that's a problem.
Well, you supported the catastrophic cap to limit beneficiaries' out-of-pocket spending, but you opposed the idea of a surcharge on supplemental coverage plans, as you mentioned. What was your argument?
First of all, the out-of-pocket maximum is an important piece and should be added to the Medicare program. It needs to be calibrated or set correctly. If you set it at $5,000 or $7,500, that really is too high for most people with Medicare. And if you combine it with, you know, a surcharge or tax on their supplemental plan, meaning they're not getting that first dollar coverage in that $5,000 to $7,000 window period, you know, they're really up the creek without a paddle. I mean, half of people with Medicare have incomes under $25,000 a year. They're already spending 15% of that income on health care costs. So adding more costs is not, you know, going to enable them to get access to the care that they've been getting access to. And that's one of the reasons for these proposals is that, you know, we're trying, MedPAC is basically saying, hey, if we get rid of this upfront coverage, this first dollar coverage, there will be less utilization of health care. And that's true, but people will get, you know, will avoid necessary services because they can't afford them, as well as them avoiding unnecessary services. And, of course, patients aren't the people to know what's necessary or unnecessary. Doctors are.
So now that testimony has been submitted to Congress, what's next? What's the process involved for making changes to Medicare program that is so beloved by so many supporters and opponents of other government services?
Well, it's true, and it's going to be. I think it's going to be a very interesting year for Medicare. Of course, we have the election cycle, which we're in. We think, you know, a lot of folks are thinking when Congress comes back, it'll be a lamed-up Congress. We may have a new president. We may not. That might be an opportunity to change the Medicare program, deal with taxes, deal with all these problems, of course, that we are talking about all the time. What we really see next year is a big battle over Medicare. A lot of legislators have their eyes on the Medicare program as a place where the federal government can save a lot of money by cutting its contribution to Medicare and increasing the contribution that people with Medicare themselves have to pay. So you have this premium support model that's out there. The House of Representatives recently passed basically saying, here's your $4,000 or whatever. Go out and buy your own insurance policy. That's all the feds are going to do for you. So, you know, that's going to be the debate next year, and these benefit changes that MedPAC has proposed are going to be in the mix, and we just want to make sure that as they're in the mix, people are keeping in mind that most folks on Medicare, as I said, over half of them are living at incomes under $25,000 a year. If you're going to put more costs on them, they're just not going to get access to care they need.
Joe Baker is president of the Center for Medicare Rights.
Quote from the news, you're supposed to believe in the character. You're not supposed to think, gee, Andy's acting up a storm. That was Andy Griffith on his easy acting style that charmed audiences on stage and screen for over 50 years. He died last week at age 86. And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to DavidEarsOnly at gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Amy Snopek. I'm Eddie Robinson.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condos since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Amy Snopek. This week last year, we looked at economic woes at the grassroots as Washington wrangled over deficits and the debt ceiling. From our July 10th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Catherine Herzog.
Everybody acknowledged that there's going to be pain involved politically on all sides.
Do not consider Social Security a piggy bank for giving tax cuts to the wealthiest people in our country.
Everything's on the table except raising taxes on the American people.
As President Obama prepared for another White House deficit and debt ceiling summit this weekend, he got warning signals about entitlement cuts from House Democrats leader Nancy Pelosi and about increasing revenue from Republican House Speaker John Boehner. But there were signs that escalating deficit reduction to the $4 trillion level over a decade or more might actually give the politicians more wiggle room, not to say less responsibility for what actually happens in those far-out years.
Each side also saw some advantage in terrible economic news last week. A meager 18,000 jobs were added last month, only 20% of even quite conservative estimates, edging the unemployment rate up to 9.2%. Small gains in private employment were undercut by the continuing loss of public jobs at all hard-pressed levels of government. Obama warned that doubts about the debt ceiling and a federal default would only make matters worse. Republicans said the latest signs of economic stall only demonstrated the weakness of White House stimulus policies, though new polling suggested public support. 60% in a Pew survey said they favored maintaining current Social Security and Medicare benefits over cutting the deficit. Only 37% support states cutting back on Medicaid eligibility to close budget gaps.
While political leaders wrangle on the national level, we thought we'd revisit some economic developments closer to the grassroots for Your Ears Only. Mortgages, bank loans, other forms of consumer credit with more immediate effect on daily life as well as the larger economy. For that, we're joined again by Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending in Washington. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me back.
Last week, the center called for requiring banks to give a good faith review of foreclosure alternatives before starting repossession. What would be involved?
Well, having your paperwork in order. Everyone's heard all the hair-raising stories of all the lost paperwork and people who are trying to get a loan modification. They call. They never get the same person twice. The paper gets lost. They're told to send something in, they send it in, the bank says they have it, then it turns out they don't. I mean, it's just a mess. Everyone's heard of the robo-signing, and the servicing standards of the major banks, it's a shambles. That's why all 50 state attorneys general are investigating them. So it's a big mess.
There were several reports last week that J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America were beginning to ease terms on loans to borrowers previously considered risky, and that easier lending generally might be in the offing. How do you see it?
Well, I don't know if easier lending, because now the law of the land, thanks to financial reform, is that banks actually have to do their job and assess a person's ability to repay a loan and to afford a loan before they can give the loan. But the problem is, this is a little bit too late and too little. Millions of people have probably needlessly lost their home and in the process depressed all of our home values and eroded all of our tax bases. It's a little late. We've been saying for years, literally years, that banks should have been a lot more to modify those loans that could be modified reasonably to fair market value. And it's just late in the game for them finally to be realizing that they should do this.
There was also a government report in April indicating looser bank standards for credit card applications, for better or worse. How do you see that?
Well, we don't see that it's looser standards. We actually think credit card reform has been very successful. You know, the industry always, whenever it's faced with some common sense oversight rather than being allowed to, you know, drive drunk, always says, oh, it's going to constrict credit, make it more expensive and cost jobs. And what we found is credit card rates have not gone up. The cost of credit has not gone up, but solicitations have, and to a wider swath of the public. So there is more credit has not constricted. I'm not sure that it's looser terms, but I do think it's more transparent.
There's a proposed $8.5 billion settlement by Bank of America with major institutional investors over subprime mortgage securities. A lawyer involved called it charting a new path to clearing away the cloud that holdings like those still cast on the economy. What's your view?
Well, I don't want to comment on particular settlements because we don't know the particulars of it, but what's really tragic is this is an acknowledgement, again, that all this craziness has not only hurt taxpayers and homeowners, but investors, shareholders. And these settlements are again, it's a little bit late in the game, and it doesn't do anything to help the millions of families who have probably needlessly lost their home or are facing foreclosure. Right now, one in every 11 mortgage holder is either in foreclosure or on the brink. That's up from one in 33 in 2003, which was last time things were normal. All of this is incremental. We have a long way to go to work through this crisis.
The Center for Responsible Lending also joined the National Consumer Law Center and other groups to protest a new proposal by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency involving national banks and state laws on mortgages, credit cards, other financial products. Tell us about that.
Yeah, let's not forget. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates national banks, it wasn't as though they were asleep at the switch and help cause this crisis. They actually helped the banks create this crisis by saying, dear banks, national banks, you're not subject. You can ignore state consumer protection laws. And we see where that's gotten us, right? But I'm sure I don't have to tell your listeners what a shambles the economy's in. And now they're basically saying, okay, we've read the new financial services reform law, and you know what? we want to go and do business as usual and tell the states to butt out. I don't think that's a very good idea. We think it's a terrible idea. Checks and balances have worked really well in this country for several centuries, and we think they ought to stay in place.
But you think that state laws are still relevant, even so much banking is now done across state lines, that the states are really paying more attention than the feds?
Oh, absolutely. States are especially their state attorneys general's offices, they often see bad practices as they crop up sooner than the federal regulators do. So they should be standing shoulder to shoulder. And we also have the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is officially going to take over from Treasury in protecting consumers at the national level on the 26th. So there should be both things. We see when you only have national or you only have state, you know, the founding fathers had it right. It's good to have a little tension between the two in the sense of not bad tension, but both watching.
You know, you talk about that new Consumer Protection Bureau, but you also blame the House Appropriations Committee for weakening its ability to enforce the laws.
Well, actually, it's actually the banks themselves, because the lawmakers wouldn't be doing this if it weren't at the banks urging. So the institutions that helped create this mess basically lost the argument on financial reform, and everyone said, yeah, let's have some common sense rules of the road, folks, so we don't have this disaster again. And now, since they lost that battle, what they're trying to do is achieve the same thing with a, you know, 1,000 cuts. They're trying to curb the funding. They're trying to make the funding more political so that the agency would have to go every year on its hands and knees. It would be funded like no other bank regulator. It would politicize the funding of the agency. And they're trying to say, instead of having one director, let's have like a commission of 3 to 5 people, which of course then gives industry more leeway to try to work their will and influence and water down the effectiveness.
Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending in Washington.
While Washington wrangles, loans and mortgages. From our July 10, 2011 broadcast, last week's disappointing report of 80,000 new jobs in June was still an order of magnitude better than the 18,000 reported a year ago. But Congress is again doing a budget fandango, considering alternatives to the automatic sequestration of $1.2 trillion next year, evenly divided between defense and non-defense spending, that both parties had hoped would scare them into a more carefully crafted compromise. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, meanwhile, was reportedly working on an overhaul of mortgage procedures that would give borrowers a more complete and comprehensible preview of the costs involved, better information and service on foreclosure procedures. I'm Amy Snopek. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more of Noel Coward's Love Song to London.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's green. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. All eyes see the Costa barrows, the vegetable marrows, and the fruit pile high. All eyes little London sparrows, Covent Garden Market where the Costas cry. Cockney feet mark the beat of history. Everett's to beat pins a memory down. Nothing ever can quite replace the grace of London town. There's a little city flower every spring unfailing, growing in the crevices by some London railing. Though it has a Latin name, in town and countryside, we in England call it London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's green. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Hey, lady, when the day is dawning, see the peaceful yawning on this lonely beat. Gay lady, Mayfair in the morning, hear your footsteps echo in the empty street. Early rain and the pavement's glistening, all Park Lane in a shimmering gown. Nothing ever could break or harm the charm of London town. In our city darkened now, street and square and crescent, we can feel our living past in our shadowed present. Ghosts beside our starlit tents, who lived and loved and died, keep throughout the ages London pride. London pride has been handed down to us. London pride is a flower that's free. London pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Grey city, stubbornly implanted, taken so for granted for a thousand years. Stay, city, smokily enchanted, cradle of our memories, our hopes and fears. Every blip your resistance toughening, from the rip to the anchor and crown, nothing ever could override the prize of London town.